afternoon. We're here for our last scheduled case, the March sitting, 11-18-1653 CR State versus Carlos A. Cummings, and 2012-18-520 CR State versus Andrian L. Smith. Well, I'll read you the lineup and times that I have. 17 and a half minutes for Dustin C. Haskell, Assistant State Public Defender representing Smith. 17 and a half minutes, David R. Karp representing Carlos A. Cummings. 25 minutes, Jacob Whitwer, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state in Cummings, and 20 minutes, Thomas J. Balestrieri, representing the state in Smith. 5 minutes for Mr. Haskell for rebuttal, and 5 minutes to Mr. Karp for rebuttal. We all agree? We shall proceed. Mr. Haskell. This is representing Smith.
May it please the court, my name is Dustin Haskell, representing the defendant appellant petitioner, Adrian Smith. This case concerns a suspect's right to cut off custodial interrogation by invoking his right to silence. In this case, Mr. Smith told his interrogator, "I don't know nothing about this stuff, so I don't want to talk about this." He then stopped talking. We ask that this court reverse the Court of Appeals and hold that at this point, Mr. Smith had effectively invoked his right to remain silent and all interrogation should have ceased. Now, factually, this case is rather straightforward, as the parties have agreed on the words that Mr. Smith used. And so we believe that there are two legal questions that remain for this court. And the first is, how does a defendant effectively invoke the right to remain silent during a custodial interrogation? And we submit that the correct standard was stated by United States v. Davis, by the United States Supreme Court, and then restated by our Court of Appeals in State v. Ross. And that's whether a reasonable officer would understand the suspect's statement to be an invocation of the right to silence. And we believe that Mr. Smith's words, "I don't want to talk about this," satisfied that standard and would let a reasonable officer know that he was looking to cut off custodial interrogation.
Counsel, I think your argument would be much, shall we say, neater if that's all he had said. But it seems to me you're picking out the one phrase. The area of the record that I'm looking at, I don't mean record of the case, but what was said between Mr. Smith and the detective. "See, I don't want to talk about. I don't want to talk about this. I don't know nothing about this, detective." Okay. But Mr. Smith goes on. "I don't know nothing. See, look, I'm talking about this van. I don't know nothing about no van." What's the other thing? What was the other thing this is about? "Detective, okay. Mr. Smith, I don't even want to talk about. I don't know nothing about this. See, I'm talking about this van, this stolen van. I don't know nothing about this stuff, so I don't want to talk about this. Detective, I got a right to ask you about it." Now, it seems that Mr. Smith, it could be argued, was keeping the conversation going out of curiosity to know basically, what do the police know? Or at least to know more about what he's being accused of doing. So why isn't he asking to have it both ways? Why isn't your position a request on Mr. Smith's behalf to have his cake and eat it too? In other words, have termination of the conversation, but also a continued dialogue with the detective where the detective tells him more.
Right. I believe that after his first statement at the outset of what you read, it is clear that he says the words, "I don't want to talk about this," and then sort of keeps the conversation alive himself and more or less reinitiates in any sort of way that would allow something to continue. I think that It's only Mr. Smith then who's talking, and I think that reading the statements in their entirety, it is evident that he perhaps was considering, yeah, I'd like you to tell me about this other issue that you're asking about, which I believe was a home invasion that the detective had begun to ask about. I want to talk to you about this home invasion. And Mr. Smith immediately begins saying this, hold on, I don't want to talk about this, and then seems to pause and say, well, hold on, give me a little bit more information, and then I think makes the ultimate conclusion, no, you know, I don't want to talk about this, I don't know anything about it, and so I don't want to talk, and then doesn't say anything, and I think that's the clearest indication that his intent is to invoke his right to remain silent, is that at that point he stops talking. It's only after the officer asserts, well, I've got a right to keep asking you, that Mr. Smith responds to any custodial interrogation after that point.
What about the lower court's observation in regard to the invocation of silence in regard to the van and not to the home invasion? Could that be what he's seeking information about? Do we know?
I believe that in his statements, he's indicating a desire to cut off questioning entirely. What precedes this portion of the interrogation is, again, about 4 minutes where the officer rather open-endedly invites Mr. Smith to talk about, and again, and this recording is in the court record, invites Mr. Smith to tell us about the van, and Mr. Smith makes a number of statements about this van. He then shifts the topic of the conversation to these home invasions. And I think I would submit that, first and foremost, these aren't separate investigations that the officers are undertaking. I don't know that the van and these home invasions, these robberies, are really all that distinct. Going through the criminal complaint, going through the remainder of the interrogation, this is a van that was used during the robberies, burglaries, home invasions that were being charged. So I guess in the first place, I don't think they're quite as distinct a set of investigations as the Court of Appeals suggests, that it really is a van that's used.
Where, in your opinion, should the detective have cut it off and said, you have invoked your right to silence, and now I may no longer speak?
I believe that it was right after, I don't know nothing about this stuff, so I don't want to talk about it. Instead of saying, I've got a right to ask you about it, I think that is the point at which the officer needed to understand Mr. Smith has invoked his right to silence. He said, I don't want to talk about this, and has decided to terminate all questioning.
But based on the back and forth that had been going on, and this is my last question, and I'll, based on the back and forth that had been going on, and the officer has no affirmative duty to, you know, kind of tease out of him, okay, so are you saying you no longer wish to speak with me? Couldn't a reasonable officer in the detective's position have determined that it's at least ambiguous as to whether Mr. Smith wants to continue the discussion given what had preceded it?
I don't believe so. And I think that's where we get into finding an ambiguity where perhaps one does not exist. That Mr. Smith had said, I don't want to talk about this, I believe, and made it clear. But there's an inherent back and forth in any interrogation. To invoke your right to remain silent during any interrogation, at some point you've waived your right and you've indicated a desire to speak. And so I think using the fact that there was previously a back and forth to now cast doubt on a seemingly clear set of words, I think creates a problematic standard that sort of swallows the rule. It becomes really easy to say, well, he was making some statements before, so, you know, he can't mean it when he says it now. I know that these words may look clear in a vacuum, but, you know, he can't mean it. And I think that that's the problem that is argued at length in our briefs in Sager v. Avila, in this Eastern District Court case, that acknowledges the problems of trying to find a context or a broader context when the words that the defendant has used are otherwise clear.
Here's what I'm going to try and ask each counsel. Okay? One, what is the standard for unequivocal invocation of the right to silence? Okay? What is the standard we use, or what is the standard the reasonable officer should use? And what is it about each of these statements that makes it equivocal? And what you just started or stopped with is, what circumstances can or should we look at? Do we look at the preceding communication? Do we look at the subsequent communication? Do we look at other things?
So first, as to the standard, I think that, again, it would be that standard from United States versus Davis and from Ross, that whether a reasonable officer would understand the defendant's statement to be an invocation of the right to silence. I think that we've used the word unambiguous an evaluation has been made as to whether there's ambiguity in the defendant's statements. And I think the problem is that there can be ambiguity in just about anything any person says. You can read it one of two ways if you're willing to find it or look for it. And I think that what a reasonable officer would hear in, I don't want to talk about this, I think the reasonable interpretation is...
So it's an objective standard.
It is an objective standard.
Not subjective. Okay.
Correct.
So what is it about this language that makes it unequivocal in your mind? Is it that this one is Smith, which he says, I don't want to talk about this, right? What's unequivocal about that?
I believe that the words themselves, I suppose, sort of speak for themselves, that I don't want to talk about this.
Okay.
What he's expected or required to do is to indicate that he wants to invoke his right to remain silent, or, again, make clear to that reasonable officer that he doesn't want to continue.
And what are the circumstances we look at? Because the next minute he talks. He's still talking, right?
He talks after the first time that he uses those words, I think. He indicates, I want to do this, and then I think backs off. I will agree with that he backs off a little bit initially, but then subsequently, I think, sort of comes to terms with the fact that, no, you know, actually, I don't know anything about it. I don't want to talk about it.
What should the officer have said instead of what he said, I have a right to question you?
I think that the officer should have ended the interrogation. I think that at that point, the officer needed to scrupulously honor the defendant's right to remain silent, and all interrogation needed to cease at that point.
There's the U.S. Supreme Court case, and my handwriting is so bad that even I can't read it. Is it Tompkins or Thompson? Tompkins?
Yes.
All right. And that took a really really tough look at what's equivocal and what's unequivocal, I think. And that I think that the defendant has to speak like an Oxford Don. I think that under that, it may be that a defendant, unless the defendant says, I unequivocally invoke my Fifth Amendment right to remain silent, isn't everything else equivocal?
I don't believe so. They indicate language in Tompkins indicates that he needs to indicate that he wants to invoke his right to silence or doesn't want to speak with police any longer. I think that Tompkins is harsh in allowing an implied waiver of the Miranda rights, and I believe that Tompkins otherwise, as far as the requirement to invoke the right to silence after one has already begun speaking, really just echoes what was case law in Wisconsin before. In State v. Ross, the state of Wisconsin had already concluded that silence alone is not enough, and that those are the facts of Tompkins, was a defendant who just remained silent. And the conclusion is, well, remaining silent does not invoke your right to remain silent. You need to actually say something to invoke the right to silence.
I'm wondering if, you know, we have, if I remember my cases, it's quite old, ask the police officers to say add another element to Miranda. I've now forgotten what that is. But maybe we should, so that people understand Miranda, maybe we should say that the police officer should hand a card over to the defendant who says something like, if I really want to counsel, I must state I unequivocally invoke my right to counsel. If I really want to remain silent, I must state I unequivocally. Maybe you need another word than unequivocally. That's a hard one to understand.
Right.
Must invoke my Fifth Amendment right to remain silent.
Well, are you answering that question?
I was going to address that, but
go ahead.
Why not finish addressing?
There are pros and cons to that. I mean, I think first, we're looking for a more workable standard than expecting recitation of, you know, a specific set of words that the person needs to use. I think that we're frequently dealing with, as is the case here, We've got an 18-year-old Mr. Smith who's being interrogated by a detective who presumably has training and experience in interrogating individuals. And so I think to expect the discrimination of an Oxford Don from Mr. Smith or even reciting from a card, you may be asking a lot. The benefit is, of course, clarity in, you know, of course, giving a card and saying you must use these precise words.
But, you know, this must be, what, the second or third or fourth case in 2 years or maybe three where the court is asked, is this equivocal or is this unequivocal, right? And, hey, is that what any Supreme Court or even a court of appeals or even a trial court should be doing? You ought to have it clear.
I suppose I'm concerned about who would be doing it if we don't have the court doing it, as then we wind up with, I suppose in this case, a detective who can continue questioning under the belief that this perhaps is not an invocation of the right to silence. And Mr. Smith is subject to this interrogation in violation of his Fifth Amendment rights. And that's just it, is that the court is asked to revisit these issues. I think that, again, kind of dovetailing with the notion that it's easy to find ambiguity in anything, that this court last year in State v. Edler, a case on invoking the right to an attorney, the defendant or the suspect had said, can my attorney be present for this? And I suppose there's a question there. So there's the question as well, can a question be unambiguous in the first place? Can my attorney be present for this? Could be interpreted as, well, am I allowed to have him present? Not, I want to have him present. And so I think it's easy to, again, I suppose that shows finding ambiguity in just about anything. I think you can find ambiguity if you're searching for it in, I don't want to talk about this. You can try to say that it's fencing or something like that. But I submit that the clearest understanding of the words, I don't want to talk about this.
Edler, is the test the same when a defendant is invoking his Fifth Amendment right to silence and when the defendant is invoking his Miranda Fifth Amendment right to an attorney?
Yes, I believe it is. I think that's what Tompkins really stood for. As United States versus Davis had set that standard previously for counsel. Yes, and so Tompkins really extended that to kind of this clear articulation rule that Wisconsin had been adopting.
Part of what tends to bother me in these cases is Miranda came out of the idea of you have these rights and you ought to warn somebody so they know what they're doing when they decide to talk or not. And the right to remain silent to me seems so fundamental that you start there. You don't have to say a word, and you shouldn't have to invoke anything. You should be able to sit there and be silent. But the problem is a lot of these cases with the cutting off interrogation have morphed into this obligation to invoke something that ought to be existing without you saying or doing anything. Your case isn't directly on point with that, because yours is more of a traditional invocation of a right during questioning. And I see waiver and invocation is slightly different than the initial starting point of your right to remain silent. But you're in the cutting off interrogation realm. And I get the test, and I get that it's unequivocal. But maybe what you should be espousing is that we adopt a rule that law enforcement add to the Miranda right to explain that you have the right to cut off interrogation, and you can do that in an unequivocal manner. What do you think of that?
I believe that in a lot of the Miranda cards that I've seen, I do not remember the specific facts of this case. I'd have to listen again. But I know that frequently there is an advisement that if you want to at least hire an attorney, you can do that at any point.
But the questioning, I don't know that that's within the typical Miranda warnings. And, you know, why isn't that a good idea if that's really the right that tends to be litigated?
And that's what, again, I think that while maybe not stated in Miranda, is traditionally read to defendants in the cases that I'm familiar with, at least, as an advisement on that, the right to cut off questioning if you desire to do so. There's nothing indicating you must do so sufficiently clearly, I will acknowledge, and perhaps that should be made clear as long as the standard is, as the Chief Justice suggested, getting closer to requiring the discrimination of an Oxford Don. Again, we'd ask that this court reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals, finding that I don't want to talk about this is a clear invocation of the right to silence.
And that's the only issue in this case?
It is.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. David Karp, representing the defendant Cummings.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court, my name is David Karp, and I represent the petitioner Carlos Cummings. The main issue in this case is whether Mr. Cummings made an ambiguous or an unambiguous request to end in-custody police interrogation. Mr. Cummings indicated that he wanted to be taken to his cell and to reserve his statement making for later. This is the gist of the exchange, gingerly edited for public reading. Detective Bean says, "I'm telling you right now, Carlos, there's enough to charge you right now, okay? This is your opportunity to be honest with me, to cut through all the nonsense, and to be honest about what you know. Carlos, I'm telling you, Detective Bean, so why then do we got Carla and Linda telling us different? Carlos, what are they telling you? Detective Bean, I'm not telling you. I'm not going to lay all my cards out in front of you, Carlos, and say this is everything I know. Carlos, well then take me to my cell. Why waste your time, you know? Detective Bean, because I'm hoping to get the truth from you. Carlos, if you got enough to charge me, well then do it. And I will say what I have to say to whomever when I plead innocent." So here we have a request to be removed from the interrogation room, an inherently coercive situation, everyone recognizes that, which is sort of ignored. And immediately on the heels of that, an indication that Mr. Cummings would like to reserve his making a statement for a different setting, for a judicial setting. And that wasn't honored. Instead, the detective follows up with questions about Mr. Cummings' relationship with one of the co-defendants. There's nothing ambiguous about it. Mr. Cummings didn't say, well, I want to be taken to my cell and save my statement making for court unless you're willing to tell me everything you know about the co-defendant's statement. That's sort of the gist of the state's argument. The state cuts off context at the point of why waste your time, you know. But if you look at the totality of the circumstances, and I think I am backing off a little bit from my position here. I think the court is going to end up with a totality of the circumstances test of some kind here.
Limit on what number of questions and answers get?
The number of questions and answers?
I mean, I don't have a quota system, but do you look to what he said after take me to my cell, or that was the other case, or I don't want to talk about this?
Chief Justice, I think that the law is pretty clear that just because a person keeps talking doesn't mean they didn't invoke their right, particularly where there was a follow-up question. Immediately after this exchange, Detective Bean says, okay, well, you know, tell me about your relationship with Carla. And in terms of this fishing for information thing, the police had throughout the interview been giving Mr. Cummings little hints about the evidence they had in order to get Mr. Cummings to waive. He did eventually sign a waiver of the Miranda rights and agree to talk. So it was a continuity here. In any case, I think it's pretty clear the state should have the burden of proof to prove the lack of an ambiguous invocation, as the state does for proving waiver. A reasonable police officer, certainly in these circumstances, should have seen that Mr. Cummings was requesting to be taken to his cell and to make a statement later. Would that I could speak with the erudition of an Oxford Don, but so be it. The average criminal defendant can't even speak as well as I do. So they're not going to really know what's going on. They're intimidated. They're in custody. And, well, I admit there are portions of this conversation where Mr. Cummings acts a little bit cocky, where he's, you know, trying to wrestle with the officer. But he's he's not going home. He knows he's not going home. He knows he's going to spend the night in the jail cell. It's not a fair fencing fight going on. The Detective Bean is eventually going to be able to go home and sleep in his own bed, and Mr. Cummings is going to be going to a jail cell. Basically, the only freedom Mr. Cummings has is to ask to be taken to the cell. He can't really be taken anywhere else.
Counsel, if I remember the Tompkins case, there the defendant in being questioned was silent for 2 3/4 hours and then spoke up. And that was enough to constitute a waiver. So what does the defendant do? Silence is not enough to unambiguously say, I don't want to talk to you. And as soon as somebody starts to talk, it's equivocal.
Chief Justice, I see the dilemma that a suspect's in, and certainly it's not enough to say nothing. You have to say or at least do something, and I think Mr. Cummings did in this situation.
So what's the test? What is the standard to determine whether it's unequivocal invocation? Do you agree with
I'm not going to muddy the waters that Mr. Haskell has poured here. I think he's right. I think it's a reasonable police officer test. However, and I think both sides are in agreement that forcing the police officer to scope out the intent of the detective is a mistake.
Of the defendant.
Excuse me. Of the suspect.
Right.
Having the police officer scope out the intent of the suspect is not something that a reasonable police officer can do, and that language certainly in some of the Court of Appeals decisions does muddy the waters, and the court might need to take a look at modifying that. Now, I don't think that it would be necessary for this court to overrule Marquardt. I am thinking that this case, Cummings, is actually distinguished from Marquardt. The parties discussed in the briefs a couple of different Court of Appeals precedents. One is Getch, in which the Court of Appeals found that there was an unambiguous invocation of the right to counsel, and one is Marquardt, where the court found that it was ambiguous.
What was said in Marquardt?
I'm sorry?
What did the defendant say or not say in Marquardt?
I just can't
remember.
Chief Justice, Ms. Marquardt said something like, I'm tired of being here. I don't want to be here anymore.
Get me in jail. Just get me out of here. I don't want to be here anymore, all right? I've been through enough today.
Yes. But she didn't say anything about wanting to make a statement later on. Whereas Getch, on the other hand, not only says that he wants to go to his cell, but that he doesn't want to make a statement now. The state would have the court distinguish Getch from Mr. Cummings' case because Mr. Getch was defeated, exhausted, but clearly Ms. Marquardt was defeated and exhausted too. So it's not the exhaustion that's the litmus test. It is the words that are said. So I would ask the court to look at the interests of the Fifth Amendment. The Fifth Amendment is meant to be a limitation on state power. And although there's been some backing off on that, I don't think that it's appropriate to seek further and further restrictions on the ability of a suspect to invoke Fifth Amendment rights in an in-custody situation. I would ask the court to hold that when a suspect requests in the midst of an in-custody interview to be removed from the interview and defer statement-making to a later time, that this is unambiguous. I believe this would protect the interests of citizens who might be suspects. It would also protect the interests of law enforcement, giving law enforcement a clear rule that law enforcement can follow. I believe.
Counsel, let me, if I might, interrupt you for a minute. Several minutes ago, you indicated that you thought that the test perhaps should be a totality of the circumstances test. Now, what that says to me is that you can't just zero in on the particular statement. You have to look at what happened before and what happens after. Do you agree with that?
Justice Crooks, I think I do. I think that the court is going to look at context. The question, I guess, is to decide which context. I think the court will eventually decide the totality of the circumstances does play into it, but this is requesting to be removed from the interrogation room and save your statement making for later on is a pretty big circumstance in the totality. Is that it? The answer that
sure.
Okay.
Sure. I wanted to be sure that you weren't foreclosing in any way looking at what happened before and what happened after, as well as the zeroing in on the statement itself.
Justice Crooks, yes. I see. I mean, both sides sort of would have an advantage in cutting things off at a certain point. But I think if you center particularly on the circumstances surrounding the invocation, that would be perhaps one of the most important circumstances for the court to look at.
In my writing in Edler, I set out the idea that the majority could have clarified whether or not law enforcement should take further steps if they think something isn't a request for counsel. And so far, I don't think that we've gone that far in any opinions to require that of law enforcement. Some courts do, though. But I thought I just heard you say you don't think that's workable and you're not advocating for that. Is that true? Did I hear you right? Is my question. I'm just...
Justice Ziegler, I think what I'm asking for is a rule that's clear for law enforcement, but I think I'm also acknowledging that it's going to involve totality of the circumstances. In this particular case, Mr.
My point is if the law enforcement thinks, okay, well, I don't really know if he's asking for a lawyer or not, or I don't really know if he's asking to remain silent, do you think law enforcement should do anything with that or just keep going?
Well, what I'm looking at in this case is Mr. Cummings not saying, well, should I just go to my cell and should I make a statement later on? I mean, Edler was sort of an interesting circumstance just because the question was, well, can I have a lawyer? Can I have a lawyer now? Can I have soup? And, you know, I have to admit that Edler came out while after I was way past the post-conviction stage of Mr. Cummings. Mr. Cummings asked, well, can I have a lawyer at any time? And I see how that's different. So I'm not arguing that. I'm not asking to say that was an invocation to counsel. Is that the answer?
Good. That's fine. Thanks.
You sent us a errata sheet because using a quote, you attributed it to the wrong case.
I'm sorry.
That's not the point of my question. That should be the largest error you or I ever make. But the quotation you sent in is using context to transform an unambiguous invocation into an open-ended ambiguity defies both common sense and established Supreme Court law. It is not that context is unimportant, but it simply cannot be manufactured by straining to raise a question regarding the intended scope of a facially unambiguous invocation of the right to silence. And then it is the famous or infamous Oxford Don quote from Justice Souter. And then it says, the defendant would meet even this erudite standard. Miranda requires only that the suspect indicate in any manner that he wishes to remain silent. So I read that to say, sure, you look at the totality of the circumstances, but you don't manufacture an ambiguity looking at the entire context if he's made an unequivocal statement, because you can make anything equivocal if you push hard enough.
I agree, Chief Justice, and I think that's the problem of the lower court in this particular case. I think the lower court, the Court of Appeals, overextended Marquardt to find that there are competing inferences that could be made where there really weren't, and that it doesn't take into account that the balance of power in the interrogation room is not even that just because someone's engaging in some sort of thrust and parry that somehow means that that suspect would have the advantage.
I find focus on the whether or not it is ambiguous or unambiguous in many cases downright unworkable. On the edges, it may be apparent if something is a clear invocation. I am invoking my right to remain silent. Or it may, on the other edge, be clear that it is not an invocation. But in the main, if we focus on whether or not it's ambiguous, I find that inquiry difficult. I think what we should be focusing on is the standard. What would a reasonable officer think? That is, would an officer reasonably think that they're invoking? Then we don't play the semantic game, in my mind. Tell me what you think about that. I can be wrong. I just want to know. I mean, you know, sometimes I don't want to know, but I do want to know today. Does that make any sense, or does that have some infirmities that you suggest?
Justice Breyer, I think I understand what you're saying, and I think that goes to the whole issue of whether or not it's appropriate to have the officer gauge intent rather than words that are said and look at the usual meanings of those words. So that, take me to my cell, I would like to make my statement later, means what it means, and it doesn't mean something else. Something either is ambiguous or isn't ambiguous. Some people would ascribe to that point of view. Is it?
Yeah, I just want a reaction. I'm uncertain of what I'm saying, and I just want your thoughts on it. So thank you.
All right, thank you. Since I have the red light, unless there are questions about my sentencing issue, I'll rest on my brief.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Whitmer, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin against Cummings.
May it please the court. My name is Jake Whitmer, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin in the Cummings case. Both of today's cases arise in a post-waiver context. It's undisputed that Smith and Cummings each made knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waivers of their Miranda rights, including the right to remain silent. Having already waived their rights, the onus was on them to unequivocally invoke their right to remain silent in the middle of the interview to cut off questioning.
In Cummings' case, How did they waive their rights?
In this case, and this is not in the briefs,
Is it in the record?
It is in the record. They both were He both signed a waiver form, which is at, I believe, record 16, Exhibit 1, at about 12 minutes into the interview. And he also was advised orally of his rights. And what's interesting about this case, and this goes to a question that Justice Ziegler had, is that in this case he was actually advised of his right to cut off questioning at any point. And so he was fully aware and was advised twice, both in writing and orally, of his right to cut off questioning.
And although he waived it, he can reassert his rights. Is that right?
Certainly, if he does so unequivocally under Tompkins.
Okay. Even if he hadn't waived it, would this his waiver make any difference, since he can assert the rights, and doesn't he have to assert them unequivocally anyway? Whether he waived or he didn't waive?
Right. I believe that in last year's Edler decision, I believe that the court did not answer the question of what the standard should be pre-waiver, and just simply assumed that the standard should be an unequivocal invocation. So I think that's an open question.
I just wanted to know that waiver really, at least in this case, is not going to make any difference because he can change his mind.
Sure. Certainly he can change his mind, but the onus then is on the suspect in these circumstances to unequivocally invoke, because he has already made a knowing and voluntary waiver. And under Davis, Davis explains that the Miranda waiver is the primary prophylactic in this instance. So once the waiver has been made, the primary rights have been waived. And at that point, a defendant must unequivocally invoke.
Counsel, I guess I'm going to ask the obvious, which is, why isn't it an unequivocal evoking of the right to silence for Mr. Cummings to say, well then, take me to myself?
Well, there are a couple of reasons for that. First, there's the context. At about 22 minutes into the interview, as counsel explained, Cummings asked the officer, what are they telling you, meaning as co-actors? The officer responded with words to the effect of, I'm not going to tell you that. And Cummings replied, well, then, take me to my cell. Why waste your time, you know? In these circumstances, a reasonable officer would reasonably view Cummings' statement as a ploy to get the officer to tell him what his co-actors were saying. And I think, second, we need to take a look at the words, and not just the phrase, take me to my cell, but what comes immediately after that, and that is, why waste your time, you know? That's a question. It invited a response. In fact, it suggested that the interview would continue, and that if the officer didn't provide Cummings with the information that he was seeking, the rest of the interview would be a waste of the officer's time. So I think even Cummings in that situation envisioned that the interview would continue.
So your point would probably be something along the lines of when a suspect makes several statements in a row, one of which could be construed as an unequivocal invocation of the right to silence, that the officer has no duty to tease out which of the statements, which part of the statements, or which part of the conversation is the true intent.
Right. Because the waiver has been made, the onus is on the defendant or the suspect to unequivocally invoke.
I'm not taking this lightly, but I would doubt that Mr. Cummings had a sincere concern over the efficient use of the officer's time. And so the question, why waste your time, seems less of a genuine inquiry than it does a way to keep the conversation going. And what's concerning, I think, about this whole issue, at least to me, is I think it's axiomatic that all things being equal, the police have the upper hand in an in-custody interrogation. As one of your opposing counsel mentioned, they are trained, Mr. Haskell, I believe, they are trained in interrogation, they are trained in techniques to elicit information. The law permits them to be deceitful in their conversation with suspects. and the average citizen simply has no way to effectively fight against that. And so that, I think, is why we are studying so intensely these statements that are made in a row. And I wonder, I articulated a potential rule, but I'm going to ask you, what do you think, besides answering, well, a continuation of the old rule and just apply it, you know, what would you think an accurate recitation of the rule from this case should be?
I believe that it should be that the standard is an objective standard. What a reasonable officer would reasonably conclude under the circumstances. Davis explicitly refers to in light of the circumstances. The circumstances and context are relevant. And what they're asked to do is to determine whether the invocation is unequivocal. And I believe that the Marquardt decision is correct in saying that if there are multiple competing reasonable interpretations of what the suspect has done in this circumstance, then it's not an unequivocal interpretation.
Thank you.
But that's a real difference. If you focus on what a reasonable officer would think, would a reasonable officer think he is invoking his right to remain silent? That's quite different from saying, would a reasonable officer believe under the circumstances that the invocation was unequivocal? That's a
yeah.
Difference.
Sure, I agree that there's a difference. I think that the standard is compelled by Davis, though, and Tompkins, which adopts Davis for right to counsel. I'm sorry, for right to remain silent, because it requires an unequivocal assertion. It's from the perspective of a reasonable police officer. So it's would the officer reasonably conclude under the circumstances that the invocation was unequivocal?
I understood you to say that the defendant received a Miranda warning and also received an admonition that he had the right to cut off questioning.
Correct.
Do you have those words? And
yes, I do.
The real significance of what I'm trying to get at is the addition of those things, those words, that advice, does that change the standard of what you should expect, what an officer, a reasonable officer, should expect from the defendant?
I don't believe that it does change the standard. Miranda itself and no Supreme Court cases since then have required the warnings to include the advisement that you have the right to cut off questioning. Miranda only requires to advise of the right to remain silent, the right to counsel, the right to have counsel appointed for you if you can't afford one, and I should remember from my law and order.
That's right. Either that or criminal law.
right, exactly. Exactly. But the right to... the right to cut off questioning is not one of those that's required by Miranda. And, of course, that anything you say might be used against you.
Let me try this one. Do you have the exact language of what the officer said about the right to cut off questioning?
I do. At about 7 minutes and 30 seconds into the video recording, the officer says this to Carlos Cummings. If you decide to answer questions now without a lawyer present, you will still have the right to stop answering questions at any time until you talk to a lawyer for advice and to have him with you during questioning if you so desire.
Well, then take me to my cell.
Pardon me?
then take me to my cell.
I think this might be a different case if he said, take me to my cell, plus I want this interview to be over. This, I'm done talking. Other clear invocations that would defeat the reasonableness of the inference that what he was attempting to do was to get information from the detective about what the detective knew about what the co-actors were saying.
Didn't he waive his rights after he was read those rights? Then the discussion happened, and now this, the issue here is what's it take to invoke your rights so to cease that questioning?
Correct.
And, you know, so it's a, he was given the rights, he waived the rights, the questioning happened, what's it take to get the questioning to stop and him to unequivocally invoke the right to remain silent?
Right.
And he's waived it. He waived it. And then, right? Unless I misunderstood it.
No,
did he say that right
correct.
After there was no waiver?
He did waive his Miranda rights after being advised, including of the right to cut off questioning.
Tompkins said it's not, did not require it to obtain such a waiver, as I understand Tompkins.
Not required to read this particular?
No, they can read the Miranda warnings and whatever the state requires, but the police don't have to get a waiver.
Don't need to get a written waiver, if
okay.
That's, yeah.
Good. They just have to give him the rights and then start questioning
yeah.
him.
Yeah, the Stevens Point Police Department was particularly careful here and they got
sure.
in writing and orally.
Right. And it still leaves the question, did he unequivocally ask to stop the questioning? And it, or, really put it the other way, did he unequivocally exercise his right to remain silent and stop the interview? And
no.
The state's position is a reasonable police officer would think he was not unequivocal.
Correct, correct. And that's really because of the three things that I've outlined so far. It's both, it's context, it's the words that were used, and it's the video evidence. And I would urge the court to take a look at the video evidence because I think it's relevant here. It was evidence at the suppression hearing. And I think it demonstrates that unequivocal assertion was not made here. Counsel's arguments at this point are a bit of a moving target, I think, because in his reply brief he argues for a bright-line rule, essentially, that whenever anyone says, take me to my cell, regardless of the context, regardless of the surrounding words, regardless of tone, gestures, anything, it always ends the interview. And I think that's not consistent with Supreme Court precedent. It's not the standard it's not the reasonable officer standard. He's asking for something like a magic words test. If you say these particular words, that automatically ends the interview, and I don't believe that that's the standard.
So if the defendant had said, I unequivocally invoke my Fifth Amendment right to remain silent, but then immediately continue talking, your position is that it was equivocal.
It depends on what he would say after he said that.
I do think
because that's such an explicit statement that it would be awfully hard for him to defeat that by saying something else.
What did he say here?
He said, well then, take me to my cell. Why waste your time, you know?
Mm-hmm. And that's my concern. Why waste your time, you know?
Sure.
It all depends on inflection, what that means. That phrase, why waste your time, you know, can mean a myriad of things, depending on the inflection. I didn't see in our brief, sometimes we have copies of the video or the recording. It's in the record, but I haven't listened to it.
Justice, I fully intended to provide in my appendix CD copies of every to all 27 copies that you have to provide. But I asked the clerk's office if I could submit that, and they said that they don't accept that format. And so,
we've had it previously, and
as I take a look at the rule, as I take a look at the rule in 809.19 sub 3, it does refer to an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper. And so,
I have to tell you, I think it was yesterday that we had. But this is our fourth day, I think, of oral argument. We had a brief, and the last page of the appendix had a disc.
Oh.
And I referred to the disc at oral argument and said, I have the disc pasted right into that page, but I didn't get a chance to look at it or hear it. And what would it tell me? And the lawyer said, well, not much. So the only, I put it in for, remember then, a couple of minutes, and here's what it would say, and et cetera. So somehow we've gotten tape, we've gotten discs, so I think it's important that videotape, that everybody should know that, and I will raise this as a question with the clerk's office.
Thank you.
But it is in the record.
It okay. Certainly is in the record.
We'll do that. We've played video and discs in the conference room for the entire court.
Sure.
More fun if it's a dog sniffing and an auto, but...
I'm sure you'd like nothing more than to continue to discuss our experience with CDs or DVDs, but are there any other points you want to make?
It's a more important point if we can see the CD. What difference do we have to give to the trial court?
Actually, it's my turn to ask the question, and I'm asking a legitimate question, and I want to hear an answer. What other points do you want to make?
I would address the Chief Justice's question as well. I have made copies of the video, and I can provide the court with additional copies. It wouldn't be through the usual procedure, but...
I'll check with the court, and if we want them, I will advise you.
Okay, great. Okay? Thank you. Additional points. Well, I think that, again, you want to look at the words, the context, and the video evidence. And I think when you do view the video what you will see is that the video does indicates that that an unequivocal assertion was not made, and you can hear it in the tone of voice. Why waste your time? You know, it's stated with very little conviction. It indicates that this is really a bit of gamesmanship. It's very important to this defendant to know at this moment what his co-defendants are saying, because he wasn't the shooter. And he doesn't know what sort of evidence they have against him. He wants to know if this woman who he manipulated, the cognitively disabled woman, actually flipped. And he would like to know what she said. So he wants to continue this interview, I believe. And that's a reasonable interpretation from, I think, a reasonable officer's perspective.
And what's our standard of review for determining whether it's equivocal or unequivocal in terms of reviewing the trial court's decision, findings of historical facts clearly erroneous,
sure.
Whether it's equivocal or unequivocal, meeting the constitutional standard is de novo?
Yes, it's a question of constitutional fact. Here in this case, the trial court did not make specific factual findings, didn't explain what inferences it would draw from the video itself. It simply concluded that it wasn't an unequivocal invocation. Now,
if we watch all this, we would say, what would a reasonable police officer think?
Correct.
Counsel, there's another issue, I think, in regard to this particular defendant, and that's the claim that the sentence was unduly harsh. Do you have anything you want to add in regard to that matter?
As as counsel for Cummings did, I would stand on my brief on that issue. I believe that the court did not misuse its discretion in sentencing, and that the sentence was not unduly harsh, given the seriousness of the offense here.
I don't hear or see any other questions, counsel.
We're invoking our right to remain silent unequivocally.
You don't have to say anything. No more talking, then. No more talking.
No more talking.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Assistant Attorney General Thomas J. Ballastrieri, representing the state of Wisconsin versus Smith. Mr. Ballastrieri.
I don't think we have to wring our hands after Bergheist versus Tompkins and say, oh, there are no circumstances in which a defendant can unequivocally invoke his right to counsel. We've got lots of cases where courts have found that there has been an unequivocal invocation. In Wisconsin, we've got Getch, we have Wiegand, and Mr. Haskell in his brief cites a number of cases from other jurisdictions where there has been an unequivocal invocation.
You know what the problem I have with them is? Sometimes I can't tell them apart. I can't tell a case where the court said it's unequivocal from another case where the court says it was equivocal, and when they use almost the same language.
I don't think that's true.
Okay.
I don't think
show
that's
me,
true. And
show
here's,
me why.
Here's the key.
All right.
The key is to look at the definition of equivocal. What does it mean to be equivocal? Equivocal means that a statement or a series of statements can reasonably be interpreted in two different ways. That's what equivocal is. So if a defendant wants to make an unequivocal assertion of his right to remain silent, or his right to counsel, either one, that's all the defendant has to do is to avoid making statements that are confusing, that are equivocating, that on the one hand indicate that he wants to remain silent, and on the other hand indicate that he doesn't want to remain silent, that he wants to keep on talking. And I think that's the dividing line in all of the cases that have been cited here. In all of the cases that Mr. Haskell cites, with one exception, you had, and in Getch and in Wiegand, you had a defendant saying something to the effect that I don't want to talk anymore, and that was the end of it. Didn't say anything else. In the cases that I cite, what you had was a defendant saying something to the effect that I don't want to talk anymore, and then saying something else, saying something in addition to I don't want to talk anymore. And it was that additional statement that made the first statement, I don't want to talk anymore, equivocal. And you have to ask, well, what did this guy mean? Did he mean to say I don't want to talk, or did he mean to say I do want to talk?
Well, I found the Tompkins case very interesting. So he's there for 2 hours and 45 minutes. And he says very little, almost 3 hours. He says a few limited verbal responses such as, yeah, no, I don't know, I don't want a peppermint. And the chair I'm sitting on is very hard. About 2 hours and 45 minutes into the interrogation, Helgert asks Thompson, do you believe in God? This reminds me of the Rhode Island case. Tompkins made eye contact with Helgert and said yes, and his eyes welled up in tears. Helgert asked, do you pray to God? Thompson said yes. Helgert asked, do you pray to God to forgive you for shooting the boy down? Tompkins answered yes and looked away. Tompkins refused to make a written confession, and the interrogation ended about 15 minutes later.
There's a lot of Catholics in Rhode Island.
Well, you know, that was to me, very similar to the talk in the police car, if I remember that case. Was it Rhode Island versus Innis that I'm talking about? Don't you think the child should get a
Christian burial.
Christian burial. Yeah, Christian burial. I couldn't remember if it said Catholic or Christian burial. And court said that's interrogation. And the guy had been silent, and this court says silence for 2 hours and 45 minutes is not an invocation. You got to say, I'm invoking my right to remain silent.
In most of these situations.
I mean, that's a tough case, I think.
Yeah.
In most of these situations,
you have to remember this, that what we have here is a formal custodial interrogation. I realize that there are cases that are different where you're just talking on the street or something.
Formal?
But in most of these cases, there's a formal custodial interrogation. The defendants are given their Miranda rights. They are told they have a right to remain silent. They have a right to counsel.
Right.
And if the police officers use the official DOJ-issued Miranda warnings card, there is also a statement on there, you have a right to stop the interrogation at any time. Not all police officers in Wisconsin have to use those, but my experience is the majority do. They use the DOJ-issued card, which clearly says you have a right to stop the questioning at any time.
Is that the sixth warning that I referred to?
I'm sorry?
Was that the sixth warning I referred to that had been in the old cases?
I think so. But anyway, the DOJ warning does specifically tell defendants that. So you have a situation now where, if I can make some kind of an analogy here, the defendant comes into the interrogation. He's wearing a cloak. This is his Fifth Amendment cloak, his right to remain silent, his right to an attorney. The police officers are required to tell him that he has a right to keep that cloak on. And in order for the police to begin the interrogation, the defendant has to unequivocally, knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently take that cloak off. Once it's off, it's off. The defendant no longer has these rights. He has waived them. He has given them up. So into the interrogation, the onus is properly placed on the defendant to clearly tell the cops, look, I've taken this cloak off when I started the interrogation. I want to put it back on. I don't see any problem with the jurisprudence of the Supreme Court and this court saying there has to be an unequivocal invocation. The cop has to specifically be told, I want to reclaim my rights that I gave up. I want to put the cloak back on.
And that is accomplished if it is communicated in a way that lends itself to only one reasonable interpretation.
That is absolutely correct.
And it doesn't, I borrow from another area of jurisprudence, it doesn't have to be so certain in time, mode, and occasion. That's a different rule. But it doesn't have to be those magic words. It has to be words under the circumstances which reasonably lend themselves to only one interpretation.
Absolutely. That is an absolutely wonderful way of putting it. There do not have to be magic words. You look at the cases, courts have found an unequivocal invocation of the right to silence using many, many different kinds of words.
Take me back to myself.
I'm sorry?
Take me back to myself.
Take me back to myself could be, depending on the circumstances. It could be, as long as there are not other circumstances that make that unclear. But I don't want to talk. I'm through talking. I want to shut up. I don't want to talk to you anymore. I want to leave. I mean, all of those things can be unequivocal invocations of the right to silence as long as the defendant then doesn't say something else that makes it unclear.
You know what bothers me about this? A good police officer is, I think, trained to interrogate and get the defendant to tell the truth, right?
I would hope to tell the truth. Yeah, I mean, I would hope that most police officers wouldn't
so,
lie.
If you want the reason you're interrogating the person as an officer is you want the person to talk, right?
Right.
So your whole being is to get them to talk, and they can use pretext, right?
They can, yes, they can.
They can lie. That's another way of saying pretext.
I would say within limits they can lie. I mean, I think there are some due process limits.
We won't go into the limits, but can say to the guy your collaborator confessed and said it was all your fault, right? And
you they can say that, yeah.
They can say that, even if they didn't get that.
That's correct, sure.
Okay. And it seems to me that if I were a police officer and I was listening carefully, I would hear ambiguity. I mean, the next question that you say, take me to my cell, I would say, sure you want that? We're going to be alone in that, and you're not going to get to the judge because it's late Friday until Monday or Sunday. And then he says, starts to talk. Isn't that what a police officer would do?
I think it's important, and I really want to emphasize this. I think it is very important that we consider statements in the context in which they are made. In the circumstances. That's what Davis says.
And the police officer's statements, too.
Absolutely. We look at everything. We look at everything that is relevant to determining whether or not there is an unequivocal invocation of the right of the right to silence. And you alluded to that, I believe it's a Ninth Circuit case where they say you can't use the circumstances.
That was Anderson. They don't say you can't use the circumstance. The first sentence says that, and I thought, that's not right. And then they explain, oh, yeah, you can look at the circumstances, but you cannot let these circumstances make something that's unambiguous into ambiguity, which is the example I'm giving you.
Right. You can't manufacture an ambiguity.
Exactly.
But on the other hand, you cannot ignore the circumstances to make something clear that is ambiguous.
No, Justice Bradley gave you one example of another area of the law. This whole discussion reminds me of statutory interpretation.
Yeah, actually there is a very
same
close analogy.
Thing.
Yeah. We're looking for ambiguity. Or we're looking to see if there is ambiguity. I shouldn't say that we're looking for ambiguity.
We're looking
to see if there's ambiguity.
That's right. We're looking for plain text.
Yep.
Plain text. And the question is, if it's plain, there's only one reasonable interpretation. That's the definition of ambiguity in our law and statutory interpretation. And since I find that you can make anything look ambiguous or plain, depending on that's a result, it's not analysis.
I'm not sure what your point is.
Well, my point is when you say it's ambiguous, that's a conclusion that you've reached. The analysis is what makes it ambiguous or unambiguous.
Okay.
And what is your analysis in your case? Why is this ambiguous or unambiguous?
Okay.
You're Smith, and he decides, he says, I don't want to talk about this.
Okay. As I said earlier, what makes something ambiguous, which is actually a synonym for equivocal,
right.
The two words mean the same thing, what makes something ambiguous or equivocal is whether a reasonable person
right.
could interpret it in two different ways, or looked at it a little differently, whether two different people could interpret the same thing in two different ways.
Why can't I interpret, I don't want to talk about this, as an invocation of silence?
If that's all he said, you could.
Okay, what is it? What particular language makes it ambiguous?
The additional language is, I don't want to talk about this. I don't know anything about this. And
so what is it? I don't know anything about this? Or is it the next sentence?
The first sentence was, I don't want to talk about this.
Okay.
Then the next sentence is, I don't know anything about this.
Right.
And then he kept mixing them all up, and he went on, and he went on, and he went on, and he went on. When he said, I don't want to talk about this, he didn't just stop. If he had just stopped there, we wouldn't be here, because that would be an unequivocal invocation of his right to silence. I don't want to talk about this. But that's not where he stopped. He went on. He went on to say, I don't know nothing about this. I don't know nothing.
He said, I don't know anything about it, and then stopped. Is that ambiguous or unambiguous?
If he would have said, I don't know, if he would have said, I don't want to talk about this, I don't know nothing about this, and he would have stopped, that's ambiguous.
That is ambiguous.
That is ambiguous.
And the words, I don't know anything, or I don't know nothing about this, is what makes it ambiguous.
It's what makes it ambiguous.
Okay.
And it's why it's ambiguous is because at the same time he is saying, I don't want to say anything, and yet, with the next breath, he is saying something. He's saying, I don't know anything about this. I don't want to say anything. I am saying something. I don't want to say anything. I am saying something. And it's worse. It would be enough if he had just said it once. But he goes on, and he goes on, and he goes on, and he keeps repeating that. So if you look at the whole thing, what is this guy saying? Is he saying, I want to stop talking? Or does he want to keep talking? And to make it even worse, he asked the cop a question, which indicates that he wants to keep the conversation going. So by the time you get through with this, you don't know what the guy's saying. A reasonable person would not know what the guy's saying. Does he want to talk? Does he not want to talk? I don't know. And a reasonable police officer wouldn't know. So that's what makes it ambiguous.
Is the Miranda warning ambiguous?
Well, that's an interesting question. My personal view is I think we tell suspects too much in the Miranda warnings. But no, I don't think they're ambiguous. I think they're pretty clear. Even though I think we tell suspects too much. You have a right to remain silent. You have a right to the lawyer.
Let's stop right there. You have the right to remain silent.
Yeah. That's what we tell them. You have a right to remain silent.
But you say, no, you don't have the right to remain silent.
Well, not once it's waived.
Well, now you're adding a little bit to the Miranda warning.
No. What I'm saying is, which is what I said before, a suspect comes into an interrogation. He's got Fifth Amendment rights. He has a right to remain silent. But if he chooses to knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently waive that right, he no longer has it. He has waived it. Once you get past the Miranda warnings, once you get past the waiver, that right to silence isn't there anymore. It doesn't exist. It's been waived. Goodbye. He's taken off the cloak, which is the analogy I used before. And once that right is waived, once it's gone, then the suspect has to do something affirmative to get it back. And that is, he has to unequivocally tell the cops, I want that right that I gave up, that I waived, I want that right back. So there are two different steps, and the analysis is completely different with each step.
I'm not your explanation about you have to, the whole business about the cloak, you take it off, you put it on, all right. I'm just saying that the Miranda warning says you have the right to remain silent. And no matter what happens after you've given that, and given that warning, if someone is silent, you say that's not enough. They must talk.
Yes.
They can't remain silent.
Absolutely.
They must talk.
Once they've given up the right, once they've waived it, and I want to make that very clear. Once the person has waived his right to silence, he has to do something affirmative to get that right back. He has to make a statement to the police officer, which in effect unequivocally says, I waived that right before, now I want it back. He has to do that.
Here's what Justice Sotomayor said. This is in dissent, in Tompkins. The court also concludes, this is the point that Justice Prosser is making, the court also concludes that a suspect who wishes to guard his right to remain silent against a finding of waiver must counterintuitively speak and must do so with sufficient precision to satisfy a clear statement rule that construes ambiguity in favor of the police. She says it's counterintuitive. The guy sits there for 2 hours and 45 minutes, and then that's not enough to invoke his right to speak. He has to silence. He has to speak and say, I invoke my right to silence.
And there's absolutely no problem with that, because the defendant has given up his right to silence and has agreed to speak.
You know what? I don't know the record here, and they don't give it well enough, but in what is labeled paragraph 5, this is Kennedy, Justice Kennedy. The prosecution does not need to show that a waiver of Miranda rights was expressed. So
you have to no, my point here is that you have to make a distinction between the initial waiver of Miranda rights and the reinvocation of those rights once they've been waived. The statement that you just read from Justice Sotomayor's opinion seems to confuse those.
Well,
and they're very different concepts.
You know what? I read it from Justice Kennedy's.
I was talking about the statement you read a little bit earlier from Sotomayor's.
Yes, that's right. Opinion. That was her statement, but the statement I read, because both you and Mr. Whitworth talk about the written waiver, which is fine. I mean, that you got that. That makes the state's case much easier. But the state doesn't need that, because there can be an implied waiver without him signing off.
Well, you need some kind of a waiver.
Yeah, implied by conduct or explicit by signing off or saying, I hereby waive. But even if it's waived, he can reinstate it.
Yes.
Okay.
And that's a different
right.
That's
We're not
a
talking
different
about waiver.
Thing. Waiver is one thing, reinvoking is quite another.
Right. And this is an invocation.
And this is a reinvocation. Right. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Haskell, you have 5 minutes, and Mr. Karp has 5 minutes.
Having heard Mr. Balistrieri's statements, I think that it's apparent that perhaps we agree on a lot more than I may have otherwise assumed. I think he's made statements that I don't want to talk and I don't want to talk anymore, followed by silence, would seem to satisfy any sort of unequivocal invocation rule. And in this case, we have Mr. Smith, again, saying substantively identical statement, I don't want to talk about this stuff, or so I don't want to talk about this, and then stop speaking. Because Mr. Smith says on two different occasions the words, I don't want to talk about this, and Mr. Balistrieri seems to be focused on the first of those statements, where he does continue speaking. I agree with that entirely, that Mr. Smith made a number of additional statements. But there is that second instance where it seems that he's indicated now, no, you know, I don't want to talk about this. And that's it. And he stops speaking. And so it would seem that that would satisfy the rule.
Do you have that in your briefs? You have the colloquy, or you have the conversation?
That is in the briefs.
All right.
That is in the quoted portion that we have. The first sentence attributed to Mr. Smith is kind of that first statement. Mm-hmm. I don't want to talk about this. I don't know nothing about this. And then the detective says okay a couple times, and Mr. Smith keeps talking. But in the last portion of that attributed to Mr. Smith, it's, so I don't want to talk about this, and that's it. He doesn't say anything else after that. It's only the officer saying, well, I got a right to ask you.
Let me just get that clarified, because I've been looking for a larger transcript, and I don't immediately have it in front of me. So I'm looking at page 2 of your brief, where you have, as indicated in the excerpt, the I don't want to talk about this from the get-go. The get-go is my words. And then at the end of this brief excerpt, you have, I don't know nothing about this stuff. I don't want to talk about this. The detective, I've got a right to ask you about it. What happened after that?
At that point, there's, and this is again on the CD that's in the record, there's a little bit of crosstalk. I think that Mr. Smith's first words after that are, yeah, you've got a right to ask me. And then after that, there's a little bit of crosstalk that it gets a little tougher to distinguish before questioning resumes. But, yeah, you've got a right to ask me. Something very close to that is what Mr. Smith responds with. The concern that I think
can
I have with the state's argument has been – oh, I'm sorry.
What you just quoted, Mr. Smith, is saying, how do we interpret that?
His statement, yeah, you've got a right to ask me, perhaps evidence of somebody who doesn't know his rights as well, or the officer's rights to ask questions as well, perhaps, as we would hope. He's been, again, advised of them, of those rights at the beginning. But as Mr. Karp and I believe Justice Gableman noted, these are not the most sophisticated individuals who are necessarily trying to reinvoke or trying to put this cloak back on with somebody who has an expertise in preventing them from putting it back on, from continuing to question them and getting them to make statements. And so I think there are two different standards that seem to be getting discussed here, and that's an ambiguous, unambiguous versus a what would a reasonable police officer interpret. And I think that as long as we get to this world where you need to speak to invoke the right to silence, to impose upon defendants a heightened standard as to how they need to make it clear, they need to say something so clearly that it is at the exclusion of any other meaning. Those words could mean nothing else reasonably. I think sort of expects too much of them. And again, we're left with a better standard under whether a reasonable officer would understand this as an invocation of the right to silence. And it seems that I don't want to talk about this advises a listener, a reasonable listener, that this is somebody who is not looking to continue the interrogation, not looking to continue speaking.
What authority do you have for your standard as opposed to the standard by Mr. Balestrieri? I think that you started out with quoting that standard that you just finished now, whether a reasonable officer would understand it to be
that standard. As I understand, it was first stated by the United States Supreme Court in United States versus Davis in their analysis of the right to counsel, and then was restated in State versus Ross in our Court of Appeals, and has been applied there. Admittedly, the Supreme Court has also used this unequivocal, unambiguous language, which I think sort of muddies the waters a little bit insofar as they seem like sort of distinct standards. And so, again, think that this reasonable listener standard is perhaps more appropriate, especially, again, in light of the defendant's need to reinvoke it, if the burden is on that person to do it already. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Karp.
You have the right to remain silent, but only if you clearly and unambiguously invoke specifically the right to silence by statement, and you then remain catatonic and mute. It's putting an awful burden on criminal defendants. In terms of who has the burden to prove the lack of an unambiguous waiver. I think that that should fall squarely on the prosecution. That there was a waiver by the suspect, by the defendant, of the Miranda rights earlier on in the conversation, either specifically or by talking, is not a circumstance that the court ought to consider among the totality of the circumstances, because we're not even there unless there's a waiver. If right up front the suspect doesn't waive, then we're not in this area of, well, was there an unambiguous invocation or not. Take me to my cell certainly has been found to be unambiguous by certain courts, specifically where it's wrapped up with a specific statement about the suspect not wanting to make a statement presently but later. I find, well, Florida is all over the map on this, but I found the shorter case out of Florida interesting in that the Florida court found that all the statements the suspect had made up until take me to my cell were ambiguous. But they said, okay, when he said take me to my cell, we're going to find that that is unambiguous. And I agree certainly that law enforcement is recognized to be a very competitive sort of work. The officer has a very high degree of motivation probably to look for ambiguity, because the officer doesn't want the interview to end usually. Usually the officer wants to keep the suspect talking, wants to try to get a confession. It's going to make it easier to get a conviction. It's going to make it more likely.
Well, the other side of that coin, counsel, is there are suspects who think that they can either manipulate the police or outsmart them, and, you know, by keeping the conversation going. And the phrases that were used in this case, including, you know, which, you know, when you spend time in the real world, is often used by a lot of people as sort of a gap filler in the conversation for the purpose of keeping the conversation going. So I don't think it's all one-sided necessarily. Sometimes the suspect thinks it's in the suspect's best interest to keep the conversation going.
Well, I agree, Justice Gableman. In this particular case, though, Mr. Cummings was already told that he was under arrest, that he was not going to be going anywhere. He knew he wasn't going to be able to talk the officer out of keeping him in custody and arranging for charges to be filed. And the thing that really strikes me about the portion of conversation where the why waste your time comes in is, well, yeah, sometimes you'll say that to yourself, why should I waste my time? You say, why waste your time, but you really, why should I waste my time? And then after that, immediately after Mr. Cummings says that, he says, I'll say what I have to say when I plead innocent. And then the officer at that point resumes the interrogation by saying, well, tell me about your relationship with Carla. So I think under the facts of Mr. Cummings' case, that there was an invocation and that the officer chose to keep the interrogation going about the facts of the case, turning from the question of when the statement would be made and what was going to happen in court and to the facts of the incident.
Isn't there another possible explanation that was raised by your opposing counsel, though, that he may have been fishing for information about what law enforcement already knew and so wanted to learn that information so that he could better develop the strategy that he viewed in his best interest as to how to proceed? Not necessarily, you know, I'm going home tonight, but, gee, I better find out what they know so I can shape things accordingly.
He may have been, anybody who's been arrested would normally want to find out why they've been arrested and what kind of evidence they have against them. And as I said, if throughout the interview, The officers are telling Mr. Cummings, well, this is what we know, Carlos. We know you lied to us. We know this is what we have. We know this happened. We know that happened. We know you lied about that previously. But when it comes right to the invocation, when Mr. Cummings says, take me to my cell, I'll say what I have to say when I plead innocent, that's not grasping for information. That's an invocation, and at that point, the negotiation to get information is basically terminated. So I would ask this court respectfully to find that Mr. Cummings did unequivocally invoke his right to silence and against self-incrimination. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. I want to thank counsel for both cases, both on the defense and on the state, for yet another argument on what is or is not an equivocal invocation. This time it's right to silence. The other cases have generally been on the right to counsel. And thank you for your arguments and your briefs. And so we end 2011 AP 1653 CR, State versus Cummings, and 2012 AP 520 CR, State versus Smith. The court will, we are adjourned for oral arguments for the month of March, and the court will meet in the conference room at 3:40?
It's almost a quarter after 3.
Is it 2:40 or 3:40? 3:40. 3:40. We are adjourned.